in the first and second class. One way that you can break up this book and divide it is by looking at the narratives and the discourses. You can break it up into five different books. And Daniel took us through book four, starting in chapter 1353 through 18. He went through the narrative of book five. This evening, we will continue on with the final discourse of Jesus, and that's found in chapters 24 and 25. One of the goals that we had in this class was to more fully recognize Christ's authority, His divine authority that's seen in His wisdom, through the things that He taught. It's seen in His character. It's seen in His miracles. And we think back to chapter 7 at the end of the Sermon on the Mount. When he finished that, do you remember what the crowds thought? They were amazed. They were astonished because he taught as one who had authority and not as the scribes. And we're going to continue to see that this evening. We saw it in chapter 23 when he talks plainly about the leaders of the day and he denounces them strongly. We will see it this evening in a comment that Jesus makes that was amazing. Would have shook the apostles to the core, to the point that they're going to ask Jesus to please explain more. So we're going to see that tonight. And Jesus will say in chapter 24 that heaven and earth will pass away, but His words do not. And that should have great impact on our lives as we think about what Jesus predicts in Matthew 24, what happens 40 years later, what He says to us now, what He says about the future, His words will not pass away. So for us to gain a better knowledge of what Jesus is teaching in chapter 24, I want to turn back to chapter 23 for a minute and see the context of what Jesus says in chapter 24. Chapter 23, He brings eight woes that He levels against the Jewish leaders for the way that they had mistreated God's law and what they were doing as a result of that to the people who were following them. It was clear that they were not going to accept truth. They were going to do everything in their power to destroy the influence of Jesus. They even went so far to say that He was casting out demons by Satan. So the ones who should have taught these people about God and about the Christ, the ones who should have been ready for Christ, were the ones who were the stumbling blocks to these people. And Jesus is going to make it clear that their heart was wrong and their motivations were wrong. I want to start reading in verse 29 of chapter 23. Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you build the tombs of the prophets and adorn the monuments of the righteous, and say, if we had been living in the days of our fathers, we would not have been partners with them in the shedding the blood of the prophets. So you testify against yourselves that you are the sons of those who murdered the prophets. Fill up then the measure of the guilt of your fathers. You serpents, you brood of vipers, how will you escape the sentence of hell? Therefore, behold, I am sending you prophets and wise men and scribes. Some of them you will kill and crucify, and some of them you will scourge in your synagogues and persecute from city to city, so that upon you may fall the guilt of all the righteous blood shed on earth, from the blood of righteous Abel to the blood of Zechariah, the son of Berechiah, whom you murdered between the temple and the altar. Truly, I say to you, all of these things will come upon this generation. A couple of things I want you to notice in these verses. First of all, he says that all of these things are going to occur upon this generation. And then he says, your house is being left to you desolate. What does that mean to you? What do you think that meant to those who heard this? Your house is being left to you desolate. What's that? Deserted? What house is that? What's the house? Temple would be included in that, right? Absolutely. Jewish culture, economy, religious system was going to be wiped out. We see the heart of Jesus, though, in his compassion. If you look at verse 37, after these woes, he says, "Jerusalem, Jerusalem, who kills the prophets and stones those who were sent to her, how often I wanted to gather your children together, the way that a hen gathers her chicks under her wings, and you were not willing." And he says, "Behold, your house is being left to you desolate." All right, so that in turn helps us think about what he's going to say in chapter 24. There was no chapter break here, but let's talk for just a minute about this temple, this temple of Herod. Of course, we know that the first temple was built by Solomon, was destroyed in 586 BC by the Babylonians. We know that Zerubbabel, with the first wave of those who were captives, the Jews came back to 536, and he laid the foundation of the temple. And then there was a long period in which nothing occurred. God sends the prophets Zechariah and Haggai to encourage the completion of the temple, and it's completed in 516 BC. And so over time, though, that temple, it broke down and it was needed some work done. So Herod the Great, in about 20 BC, began this project to renovate and expand that second temple. And we read in John 22:20 that this project took 46 years. And we also read, we can read that there were things being done to the temple even years after that, even up to 70 AD. If you look at this picture here, this is just of the inside, the actual temple, and it shows up here on the top, if my laser works, the size of a football field. You compare that to the holy place in the women's courtyard, so that's longer than a football field. So when you go back and you look at this, you see the extent. This is huge. I was reading somewhere that this would take up 37 acres of space. Massive. If you look at what Josephus, Jewish historian, said, he said a lot of things about the temple. I just pulled one thing out. He says that the stone was exceptionally white, that limestone. And the glitter of the stone and the gleam of the gold reflected many miles away in the bright sun. And so this would have been a source of pride for the Jews. So when Jesus says, "Your house is being left to you desolate," that would have been a major impact to them. So he was leaving the temple for the last time. This is the last week of his life. And Mark 13 says that they said, "Teacher, behold, what wonderful stones and what a wonderful building." And Jesus says, "Do you not see all of these things? Truly I say to you that not one stone here will be left upon another which will not be torn down." Wow. That's authority. And the fact that he was able, that it came true, as he was reigning from heaven at the right hand of God, 40 years later, the king and his word held true, and that's exactly what happened. So let's jump ahead 40 years, and let's talk about this, the Jewish revolt for just a minute. So 66 A.D., you had the problem, the clash between the Jews and the Gentiles. Religiously, you also had the friction that came because of the oppressive taxation and imperialism, and the Jews began to revolt in 66 A.D. The Jewish forces expelled the Romans from the city of Jerusalem. In response, Nero, the emperor, sends Vespasian, his general, to deal with the Jews. He starts up in Galilee and he works his way down, wiping out the Jews. He makes his way to Jerusalem for the siege, and then Nero dies. All right, so Vespasian is the general. His son is Titus. Nero dies, and so Vespasian has to go back to Rome, and so there's a period of inactivity. And then when he becomes the emperor, he assigns his son Titus to become the general, and eventually he comes. There's a 4 or 5 month siege on Jerusalem, in which horrible things happen inside the city walls, and finally it is leveled. It was destroyed as well as the rest of Jerusalem. So many people died of famine, and others who wanted to save their lives by surrendering to the Romans, they were killed by their fellow fighters. And so here's a picture of the Roman Forum. So this is on the end of the Forum, looking back. And you can see over here is the Colosseum. When you leave the Colosseum and you head toward the Forum, you have to walk through this arch here. That's called the Arch of Titus. It's really interesting. If you go through the Arch of Titus and you look on the left, you think, oh, what the, that's interesting. So the arch was constructed in 81 A.D. by Titus's brother, who was Domitian, who became the emperor once he died. So he had the father Vespasian and then Titus and then Domitian. And so he put this up, deifying his brother, and it celebrates the Roman victory over the Jews in Jerusalem. And so if you look at this panel on the left-hand side, you go through, it's kind of interesting. It says the south inner panel depicts the spoils that were taken from the temple in Jerusalem. The golden candlestick is the main focus. You see that in the yellow. You also see the gold trumpets, the fire pans that were used in the temple, as well as the table of showbread. 81 A.D. is when this was built. Once again, that ought to make us just ring the words of Jesus in chapter 24 and verse 35. Heaven and earth will pass away, but my words will not pass away. And of course, we know that it's wiped out. And I know some of you have been to the Holy Lands, and you've seen this Western Wall that I read that it's 160 feet long by 62 feet high, and it's also deep in the ground. It's the only thing that remains of the wall that's surrounded the mount. And anyways, that's a holy place to the Jews now. I won't bring up anything there. And it's... All right, so Jesus came out of the temple. Those are the words he said. They would have come out of the area, gone past the Kidron Valley, and gone up to the Mount of Olives. Chapter 24, 25 is called the Olivet Discourse because they're on the Mount of Olives. Okay, so Luke tells it's like four different, as Andrew, Peter, Andrew, James, and John maybe came to him and they said, okay, we have some questions for you. Matthew 4:3, it says, when shall these things be? What are these things? What are they asking? When shall these things be? What is it? What had he just said? Which is referring to the actual wiping out of the temple in Jerusalem. Yeah, when are these things going to be? And then they ask, what shall be? So that's what I said, it's the temple being destroyed. And they said, what shall be the sign of thy coming and of the end of the world? And if you look at Mark and Luke, their accounts, they just ask the two questions. When shall these things be? And what shall be the sign that these things will be accomplished? Matthew adds one, it says, end of the end of the world. I think when they thought of the city being destroyed, this temple being so huge and glorious and massive, being wiped out and not one stone being left on another, in their minds, they probably thought to themselves, this is the end of the world. So perhaps in their minds, that's what they were thinking. It was all together. When this happens, this has to be the end of the world. Let me just state that there are different ways that you can view this chapter. There are a lot of wild things that are brought out from this chapter that I don't agree with. Premillennialism, preterism, realized eschatology come from this. But here are a few of them, and I think some of you may have some of these views. So there's a view that says, verse 4 through verse 28 is referring to Jerusalem being destroyed, and the rest of the chapter deals with final judgment. Others say verse 4 through 35. Others might say verse 4 through 41 is the destruction of Jerusalem. After verse 41 is referring to final judgment. Others say verse 4 through 51 is dealing with the entire chapter deals with Jerusalem being destroyed. And there are some who say that the parables that we see at the end of chapter 24, the one parable, and then the two parables in chapter 25 are in the context of Jerusalem being destroyed, and then the judgment scene in verses 31 through 46 is final judgment. Then you have others who say that all the parables in the judgment scene are in the context of judgment on Jerusalem. Then there are others who say that the parables in the judgment scene are in the context of the final judgment. I just want to tell you, following along with Sewell's material, and I've heard him preach on this before, and I believe what he says. I'm not dogmatic about it because these other men who and women who believe these things make some really good points. I think Eric Borlaug, Susan was saying that he taught this in Mark, and he taught that the entire chapter was regarding Jerusalem being destroyed. I went to listen to it, and the one class that was missing in Mark was that particular class. So I don't know where it is, what happened to it, but hopefully I'm not wrong. So I'm going to take the view that Sewell had us follow in his lesson, that verses 4 through 35 are dealing with Jerusalem being destroyed, and the rest of the chapter discusses final judgment, and that the parables and the judgment scene are in the context of not Jerusalem being destroyed, but of the final judgment. Yes, sir? Who's that? Sewell Hall or Mr. Borlaug? Well, you can always change your mind, right? But that's the good thing. So the point I was going to ask you was, and I threw it up here, regardless of which position you take on this, I think the principle is be prepared, right? I think we can all agree on that. Be prepared. All right, so let's look at these things. I'm going to try to fly through this pretty quickly. So all of these things will come upon this generation. That's what we saw in verse 36 of chapter 23. And then all of these things that are mentioned in between that and verse 34 of Matthew 24, I think, happen within this generation. That's what this says. This generation will certainly not pass away until all of these things have happened. That's verse 34 of chapter 24. So the things between Matthew 23, 36 and Matthew 24, 34, it says these things are going to happen in this generation. It's near. And so the famines, the earthquake, the persecution, the fleeing to the mountains, the tribulation, the sun and moon being darkened. The context is important. It's near. This generation, all of these things. All right, so keep that in mind. If you disagree with me, you can let me know. Like I said, I'm not going to get bent out of shape about it. But so when you look at the actual term, the actual definition of a generation, Vines says it's 30 to 40 years. So if you look at when Jesus was making, he was saying these things, would have been about 30 A.D., well, 40 years, one generation later, would have been 70 A.D., when Titus came and wiped out the city and the temple. So there are some signs that Jesus gives that are not signaling the end in verses 5 through 12. What are the signs not signaling the end? Throw them out there. All you got to do is look down at verse 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, and throw them out. False prophets, that's a sign, but it's not signaling the end. Great tribulation. Wars and rumors of wars. You're going to hear about all of these things. What else is there? I think there were four or five of them, maybe. Earthquakes, famine, pestilence. Yeah. Many will claim to be the Christ, verse 5. Wars, famines, and earthquakes, 6 and 7. Persecution will find you. Many will fall away. False prophets will mislead many. Lawlessness will be increased and people's love will grow cold. And you can look at Scripture. You can find these things in the Scripture. You can look at Josephus. You can look at Tacitus, who was a Roman historian. All of these things point to these things occurring. And so, what are the signs then that signal the end? The end was coming. What are the signs signaling the end? In verse 14 and 15. What's the first one in 14? Yes. So before 70 AD, was the gospel preached throughout the world? The known world at that time, which is what I have down in the bottom, equivalent to the Roman Empire. Yeah, if you look at Colossians 1:23, the book would have been written about 62 AD. Paul says, indeed, if you continue in the faith, firmly established and steadfast, and not moved away from the hope of the gospel that you have heard, which was proclaimed in all creation under heaven. And then Romans 1:8, he talks about the faith of the Romans being proclaimed throughout the whole world. Right, so this is a sign that the end was near. What's the other sign that's mentioned in verse 15? When you see this, know it's near. It's at hand. What do you see in verse 15? Yeah, the abomination of desolation. The abomination that causes desolation. Well, what is that? Well, we know the Gentiles would have been viewed that way, and being inside of the temple would have been a horrible thing to have the Gentiles. You can read about from Josephus about all the Gentiles who are inside of the temple. But in this case, I want to let Luke define what the abomination of desolation is. Because if you look at his account, he says, but when you see Jerusalem surrounded by the armies, then recognize that her desolation is at hand. Okay, so when you see that, flee from Judea. Can you escape? Yes, you can. All right, so when you see these things, when you see these signs, it's time for you to move, leave, flee from Judea to the mountains. Don't turn back to get your coat. Leave. And woe to you if you're pregnant and nursing. And pray that your flight will not be in the winter or on the Sabbath. All right, so these are the signs signaling the end. The end is coming. And then you're going to have this great tribulation. For then there will be a great tribulation such as not occurred since the beginning of the world until now, nor will be. Unless those days have been cut short, no life would have been saved. But for the sake of the elect, days will be cut short. Josephus, in his book, The War of the Jews, this is what he wrote about what he saw. So he was watching all this. He was captured. He was a general, and I think a priest in Galilee. He was captured by the Romans. Caesar liked him. He turned him into his historian, and he was with Titus during the siege. So he was writing these things as they occurred. He says, it is therefore impossible to go distinctly over every instance of these men's iniquity. I shall therefore speak my mind here at once briefly, that neither did any other city ever suffer such miseries, nor did any age ever breed a generation more fruitful in wickedness than was this. From the beginning of the world. He's talking about the Romans and what they did. All the calamities which have befallen any nation from the beginning of the world to now were but small in comparison with those of the Jews. So that was his view of what he was seeing at this time. I'll just point out that what he wrote is that 1,100,000 Jews died at that time. So they, you know, a lot of people fled the land and went into Jerusalem inside of the walls. They also said that when they attacked, it was a few days before the actual Passover. Of course, how did he know it was 1,100,000? I read somewhere it's likely he didn't exactly have the number right, so it may have been too high. But you had these factions inside of the city that were fighting each other while the Romans were around the city, and they killed or made slaves of those who left. Those who tried to leave the city, they would often be killed by the people, by the Jews inside of the city. There was famine. That's where we read about the mothers who would eat their children. It's just horrible. In Romans, it said they made 97,000 Jews slaves in addition to all the killing that went on. Great tribulation indeed in one city. So you get to verse 27. Wait, Barry. This talks about the coming of the Son of Man. Surely this is referring to the literal physical appearance of Jesus. And that's reasonable. And you can look at these words that I have up there that Now, some people say, okay, if it's these words, it means they refer to someone being present. So those who say that starting here, you have the literal return of Jesus, second coming of judgment. But I will point out that if you look at Matthew 16:28, for example, what did Jesus say? Truly I say to you that there are some of those who are standing here who will not taste death until they see the Son of Man coming in His kingdom. So is the establishment of His kingdom. It wasn't a physical return, but yet He talks about when you see the Son of Man coming. Same type of language in John 14:16-18. When He's talking to the apostles, He said He's going to send a helper to them, the Holy Spirit. He says, I will come to you. He didn't physically come to them. He sent them the Holy Spirit. And one other one in Revelation 2:5, He says, repent and do the deeds you did at first, or else I am going to come to you. That wasn't a literal return, but it's judgment that would come upon them. So, and once again, I'll point out that all of these things are going to occur, it says in verse 34, during this generation. All of these things will take place. Well, then you say, well, wait a minute. When you get to verses 29 through 31, this language here seems to be referring to final judgment. Now, look at this language. But immediately after the tribulation, I think the culmination of the actual tribulation would be the fall of Jerusalem. Right after that, the tribulation of those days, the sun will be darkened, the moon will not give its light, and the stars will fall from the sky, and the power of the heavens will be shaken. And the sign of the Son of Man will appear in the sky, and then all the tribes on the earth will mourn, and they will see the Son of Man coming on the clouds of the sky with power and great glory. This language is Old Testament language that is referring to cosmic language of a local judgment or a national type of judgment. You can look at these passages and you'll see that this language is used in the Old Testament. And for example, Isaiah 13, look at the phrases I've underlined. Well, for the day of the Lord is near. The day of the Lord is coming. Talks about the stars of heaven and their constellations will not show their light. The rising sun will be darkened and the moon will not give its light. Therefore, I will make the heavens tremble and the earth will shake from its place at the wrath of the Lord Almighty in the day of His burning anger. So you see, this is a language referring to a nation. God, His judgment was coming upon this nation. And here you have another one. For Egypt, it says, behold, the Lord is riding on a swift cloud and is about to come to Egypt. He wasn't coming literally and physically. His judgment was coming. All right. So, I would therefore say that this is still referring to the destruction of Jerusalem, even that language that we see in verses 29 through 31. And so, once again, he brings up the image of the fig tree, which is interesting how Jesus has used that throughout the gospel. But once again, he brings it up. He says, learn the parable from the fig tree. When its branch has already become tender and put forth its leaves, you know that summer is near. So you too, when you see these things, recognize that He is near. And once again, all of these things are going to occur in this generation. So once again, there are signs to observe, to watch for. And it's time-bound. This particular judgment, there are signs to observe, and it's time-bound. Which gets us to verse 36, where I believe there is a contrast. There is a change. But of that day and hour, no one knows. Not even the angels of heaven, but my Father only. So Jesus' return in this case, physical return, literal return in judgment, is during normal times. Remember, he brings up Noah. There's no signs to be observed as a warning. No possibility of escape, which is what we had just seen. When you see these things, flee to the mountains. You could escape that judgment because it was a local judgment. But this one, you cannot escape. So instead of a limited judgment upon a nation, all the nations will be gathered before him, and he will separate them one from another as a shepherd divides his sheep from the goats. So he says, be ready. Verse 37, for the coming of the Son of Man will be just like the days of Noah. Then there will be two men in the field. One will be taken and one will be left. Two women will be grinding at the mill. One will be taken and one will be left. Those who believe that this all refers to Jerusalem believes that the Romans would come in. They would take one, but they would leave the other. So this, perhaps, is highlighting that one will be saved and one will be lost due to the readiness to obey Christ. So therefore, be on the alert, for you do not know which day your Lord is coming. So what they would say is, those who believe that the chapter is all dealing with Jerusalem, they say, okay, you have these signs, but you don't know the exact hour and day when Rome's going to attack. That's what I read, but once again, I think this is referring to final judgment. Be on the alert. For this reason, you must also be ready, for the Son of Man is coming at an hour when you do not think he will. Which launches us into three different parables. But I'll stop before I get into the parables and ask you if you have any comments, complaints, concerns. Okay. Well, that's good. Yes. Yes.
We need to remember that that was so familiar to them. When you look back at different Jewish writings in the first century, that was very common terminology. Just like we might say a wave of grief.
Yeah.
And no one would say that you were suddenly at the ocean. We know what we mean when we say a wave of grief.
Right.
This would have immediately stood out to them.
Absolutely. Context is important. And understanding the times in which these were written and what they would have known and believed in is extremely important. So Jesus then begins with these three different parables. And Chumley, who I quote from, actually has a view that's different on chapter 24 than what I just brought up, which is interesting. So I'm saying there's some really good folks who have great knowledge, who have different views of this chapter. But he brings up that in all of these parables, you have a figure who's representing the Lord, who's gone away, his coming is delayed. Two groups, one's prepared, one's not prepared. They will explain why someone is prepared, why someone is not prepared, and then it will describe the rewards and the punishments for each. So the first one that's brought up is this, the parable of the servant, the evil and the good servant. So who then is the faithful and wise servant in this first parable? Is it verse 45? Who is faithful and wise servant? What are they doing? What actions? It's actually verse 46. Blessed is the slave whom his master finds so doing when he comes. So this is the one who is found faithfully at work when his master returns. He's been gone for a long time. He's ready. He's prepared. He's working. He's doing what the master wanted him to do. The evil servant, on the other hand, we know, is not expecting the master for a long time. He throws off his constraints. Everything's okay. The Lord isn't returning. The master isn't returning. He changes the way he acts. He isn't diligent. He isn't doing what the master says. And so, as a result, the faithful and wise servant is put in charge of all of the master's possessions. And then the servant who's evil is assigned a place with the hypocrites, where there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. It leads us into chapter 25 with the second parable of the 10 virgins. A little bit of background on this. So we know that the wedding was preceded by a betrothal, which we know is binding much more than what we have today in the engagement period. It could only be ended via divorce. It was a serious thing. So when the time came for the marriage to be consummated, you had the bridegroom who's off with his buddies, his companions for a time, and then he proceeds to the home of his bride. So in Oriental weddings, they were celebrated in the evening, so the bride's companions would wait for the bridegroom, and they would light the way for the bridegroom to come to the bride. And so they would be there with their lights, with their lamps to be able to light the way. And so the bridegroom, he was delayed for a period of time. And so the bridesmaids were sleeping until they heard the cry, the bridegroom is coming. And we know that five ran out of the oil for their lamps, and those that were wiser refused to share their oil because they brought some oil with them. And they said, no, we're not going to share it. Now, you can go buy some, but they couldn't find any. And so though this is around a joyful event, it's speaking soberly of how a judgment is coming, and that needs to guide the way that you act, that we act, that they act at that time. It had to change their views and their actions. And so it says, be on the alert then, for you do not know the day nor the hour. Notice that the door was closed. The five were let in, and the marriage feast was closed. Perhaps it should be called the parable of the closed door. The door is closed. What lessons do we learn from this? What kind of applications do you see in this parable of the ten virgins? James? Right. Excellent point. One of the main ones, we need to be always diligent as a follower of Christ, always busy in doing His work. Yes, Jerry. Yes. Yeah. I can't rely on you. I can't expect you to be able to do the work for me. It's up to me. I'm the one who's accountable. Yes, Annalie. Be known by God? Yeah, we don't know you. Interesting, Matthew 7:22, those who had done all these great things, what did the Lord say? Depart from me, I don't know you. So there can be those who think they're religious, who are doing great things for the Lord, and the Lord don't know, because once again, they're not giving their heart completely to God. And here we have people who are slacking off. Yes, sir. Right. Always being ready, right around the corner. Never letting down your guard. So the failure was in not being prepared to meet the bridegroom whenever he came. Even Christians can choose to live their lives, and we've seen this over and over again, as if the things that are going on in the world will always be this way. 2 Peter talks about that, right? Chapter 3. There's no testing. Things are great in my life. There's no death, no judgment. Great temptation to us to let the events around us to shape how our faith responds and acts. Persistent faith that pays no attention to the way things look at the moment will save us. What we have to do, I think Janice was saying, we have to allow the character of Jesus, just like the Sermon on the Mount with the Beatitudes. Sometimes it's hard to know exactly what the right... If you're the right kind of person, you will do the right things. You will say the right... If your heart is right, we have to so imbibe the character of Jesus in our lives that we're always ready for whenever the Lord returns. Yes, Janice? Yeah. That's a great point. Yeah, that's good. Quit letting their light shine and being an example. A godly character and obedience are not transferable in a crisis. They must be chosen and cultivated. The righteousness of others will not save us in judgment. Sewell is my father-in-law. Guess what? That's not going to help me in judgment day. You'd think it would, but not going to work for me. history is moving to a grand conclusion when the doors are going to be shut. Are we ready? Third parable. While the parable of the virgin stressed the need for watchfulness, this third parable shows that watchfulness is not passive waiting, but active responsibility of disciples. What was the basis for the master's allotment of his property to these three? Well, yeah. So he gave 1-5, 1-2, and 1-1 based on their abilities. What difference do you see in the master's response to the 5 and the 2 talent servant? Any difference in the response when one handed back 5, another handed back 2? Same response, right? What do you learn from that? It's like, wait a minute, shouldn't the one with five be praised more? Do our best. I can't do what Jake does. I can't do what Russ does, but you know what? I can do what I can do with the talents, the abilities, the opportunities that the Lord has given me, and that's what I'm going to be held accountable for. His expectations of his followers is tempered by their abilities. What was the sin or the sins of the one talent servant? What did he do with his one talent? Buried it. Did nothing with it because of fear of the master. And he was eventually called, was it lazy and wicked was how he was called? What would you say the master desires of his servants? What does the Lord expect from each of us? I know it's kind of hard to pick out, but effort, faithfulness, do what we can do. All those are good. This is what I wrote down. The Lord seeks the wholeness of the heart. Love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your mind. If you do that, you're going to be ready. You're going to be involved and active doing the Lord's work. further application, God's not going to judge me according to what He expects of others, but according to what He expects of me. The man who had one talent, for those of us who have one talent, we need to fight that temptation. Say, you know what, I'm not going to do this because this person who has two talents or five talents, they can do it. Fight that because you need to be busy. You need to be doing and involved in the work here. And the body of Christ is enriched and empowered by each member serving humbly according to the grace that's given. Romans 12, great passage. Okay, the last one is the king and his judgment, which isn't a parable, but Christ is going to appear in his glory. So here's the king. In judgment, all the nations come before him. He divides into two groups. Those who are the sheep and not the goats, those are the ones who gave food and gave drink and gave shelter and gave clothes and looked after the sick. They were using the opportunities and their abilities and their talents for the Lord. They didn't hide those things. They were busy helping out and doing things for them. The righteous used their opportunities. And they were merciful to Christ. They showed compassion and service. Jesus says, He who receives you receives me, and he who receives me receives him who sent me. So the things that count most with Christ are not the great things that require this great intellect or skill, but the love and mercy that every man can show one another. And those who are unrighteous, says, go into eternal fire prepared for the devil and his servants. At the end of the world, the king is going to judge us based on the way we responded. If we responded in faith, the choices that we made. I am accountable to the Lord. The king judges in part on how we treat our fellow humans. Are we selfless? Do we show compassion? But let me point out, this list is not exhaustive. We can't say, okay, I gave to the poor, so therefore I'm okay. Well, how about faith in God? How about morality? How about sound doctrine? How about how we treat the rich? Is that important as well, just as much as how we treat the poor? Absolutely. There is so much more to being a follower of Jesus than just this list. Don't lose sight of that. Watchfulness is not passive waiting, but it's active responsibility toward God and all mankind that even the one talent man can accomplish. Last slide. When God warns of judgment, it's going to happen. His words will not pass away. This world will end one day. It will come like a thief, in which the heavens will pass away with a roar, and the elements will be destroyed with intense heat, and the earth and its works will be burned up. Since all of these things are to be destroyed in this way, what sort of people ought you to be in holy conduct and godliness, looking for and hastening the glory, the coming of the day of God? Therefore, beloved, since you look for these things, be diligent to be found by Him in peace, spotless and blameless. We will start with chapter 26 and go through chapter 27 on Sunday. Thank you.